Hi, this is Danny Bedoni. Anybody there?
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. First, thanks for the responses, the answers to the questions that I sent around, and the feedback about the first seminar and the kind words. I really appreciate it, and your responses help me to know what is most relevant to you and how to shape some of the conversation that that we'll have. So first, any comments or questions or clarifications, anything you'd like to add or ask before we launch into our second seminar? I have a volunteer for presenting a case vignette for our last seminar, week four, the seminar four. And I'm looking at getting a specific discussant for that as well as discussing it myself. I would welcome any of you who have a case or case vignette to present briefly, or just send me a list of questions or things that you'd like us to talk about more. Or maybe initially, if we didn't cover it and it's along the theme of what we're talking about, I would love to be guided by you and the things that would be of most help to you in your practice and in your practice development, especially in this area. So, final call, any input, thoughts, anything before we move into our seminar? Okay, well, I'll reserve a bit of time at the end for any questions or things that you'd like to discuss. So hang on, I'll put you on lecture mode, and you won't have to worry about the background noise. Okay, remember last seminar that we moved the last section in the outline under Seminar 1 to begin this Seminar 2. This initial discussion is one of the most common derailments of sustaining success, and especially of navigating the accomplishments of success that we're discussing. Remember that our discussion is simply a prototype of how, as coaches, we will see situations, have seen situations, more likely, that have had to do with challenges of regulating states of mind, sustaining a strategic system, and especially of creating a new one when there's no model or precedent. Variations here of the vampire problem, as you saw earlier. We already have a beginning. And again, I want to emphasize, if you have a case, send it to me. So we're going to talk about unforced errors. And this is in your outline at the end of Seminar 1. Is there a systematic way to recognize and prevent unforced errors? This is the way a client may initially present to you. An unforced error is one that is both completely self-generated and avoidable. Mistakes that can sabotage a performance or a reputation need to be studied as certainly as success strategies. This term, unforced errors, came from Dr. Leo Levin. He introduced it in 1982 to describe an error in tennis competition that, as he put it, is committed without a cause. In other words, the other player did not force the error. It was totally self-generated. For an unforced error, the cause doesn't originate from any external circumstance, but self-imposed. Often the player or the business person who makes fewer unforced errors succeeds or wins. Coupling that with a quicker recovery results in more successful performance. So our focus in this series, again, as a prototype to represent a number of other things, but I think it's more helpful to have a specific reference and focus, then we can apply other things to it. Extreme success brings its own neural chemistry, its own mindset, its own challenges. At times, the experience of invincibility and accompanying self-indulgence can increase the likelihood of unforced errors due to diminished objectivity. The intoxication of extreme success can be a gradual pattern of justified action, stepping over boundaries, and more with no end point. Like the frog not recognizing that the water is gradually getting hotter 1 degree at a time until it's too late. Well-known scenarios occur in the relentless pursuit to continue the stimulation of excitement, such as the taking of performance-enhancing drugs, risky investments, unethical behavior, an exciting but bad-for-you new relationship. Because unforced errors are not always conscious or logical, simple reflection and self-assessment can be elusive. It's like when there's a success intoxication, that state takes over the story and becomes a story of its own. Self-assessment can be elusive, like for unconscious biases, inattention blindness, other judgment calls that may not initially be recognized by the person who initiates them. Now, a simple mistake is not an unforced error, but defending a decision in the face of contradictory evidence, digging in your toes, can create an unforced error. This need for objectivity emphasizes the role of a trusted advisor, confidant, mentor, or coach. This is where you guys come in. A non-operating unforced error is the result of bad judgment regarding discipline, self-control, or character. A non-operating unforced error, such as sexual misconduct with an employee, insider trading, other ethics violations, arrogance, a sense of entitlement, or a failure of empathy can result in either type of unforced error. An operating unforced error is simply making a bad decision and sticking to it. Some examples you'll probably recognize. The introduction of New Coke in 1985 by CEO Roberto Gonzaga. The GMC and Ford marketing push of SUVs while gas prices were soaring. This is the first time for those of you a bit younger, in the 80s. Extreme success that transcends usual experiences and known models can create a great deal more vulnerability. And always, the way to end any discomfort is to go back to the familiar. In this case, to leave success and return to the usual. If the immediate discomfort is treated in this way, success and its pursuit are abandoned. Here's a very simple example, and I know you've heard this. For all lottery winners of $3 million or more, within the first 5 years, over 80% declared bankruptcy. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. They didn't sustain the aftermath of success. Now, here's one model. It's a tool for you to use as mentor coaches. It's a roadmap system for unforced error. Now, the roadmap, as you see in the outline, is the acronym for the 7 steps of a systematic, scientific way to really understand, to deconstruct and understand personally created stories to strategically create new behavior. Now, those of you who have done other seminars, trained, or done mentor coaching with me will recognize that the roadmap is simply a systematic way to co-create an exploration of understanding how to construct a story. That story can be applied, as here, for unforced errors. It can be applied to wellness, to a new money story, to any number of things. We'll revisit this concept. It's simply 7 steps, the acronym is ROADMAP, to apply algorithms, which, as you know, are a finite series of steps to solve a problem, to address how to understand and change your story or create a new one. This system is one blueprint of story construction to understand and address how the mind and brain creation of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors can be organized into a performance or a behavior story, or to understand something like unforced errors. So let's look at a brief overview of this, and this is, again, in your outline. Recognize that you're making an error. You can't change what you don't see. So an initial challenge is we don't always consider that everything we think, feel, and experience is our creation at that instant. Whatever we experience, we either create or accept. Secondly, own the responsibility of committing the error. Taking ownership and responsibility begins with personal recognition of the error, and that's not easy. And its impact, also not easy. For example, to incorporate feedback and self-reflect, to admit an error is a first step to reverse and enhance performance by doing that. Third, assess the unforced error and the mindset that accompanies it. Assessment can cover preparation, execution, and impact to look at the error at all levels. Next step, decide a next best action to initiate a new approach. Map changes based on information and a systematic plan to a specific goal. Create a map, in other words. Next, to author, to initiate the corrective action incorporating feedback and personal judgment for responsibility. Now, an action plan may involve individual as well as family changes or leading team changes. The adjustment from an unforced error to successful accomplishment involves both undoing and doing, just as new learning involves both unlearning and learning at the same time. And finally, program new identity. Each step of success needs to be metabolized, internalized as an evolving transformation of identity. We always return to our identity. If you create a change or help a client create a change that's not incorporated into their identity, they'll revert back. So, we can apply this roadmap. The question, can passion itself create an unforced error? I would say it can. Passion alone can manifest as obsessive pursuit and create tunnel vision. A well-known example that I bet you guys have heard of. You may have even seen the Hulu documentary. Elizabeth Holmes, founder and CEO of the biotech company Theranos. Holmes was at one point the youngest self-made billionaire at $4.5 billion. Her initial pursuit of passion generated unforced errors with loss of grounding in ethics and ideals. Unforced errors are especially likely to occur when someone loses sight and probably even enjoyment of the game and focuses only on winning. And it can be compounded when the success is so huge that there are no previous experiences or reference models. And in the case of Elizabeth Holmes, she brought a whole group of people along with her that both reflected and even exaggerated that kind of excitement and losing oneself. So here's a question, a summary and a bridge to our next topic. How to address fundamental challenges following remarkable success. Keep these three elements in mind when you deal with extreme success and when you work with a client in dealing with extreme success. One, sustain a growth mindset. You ain't done when you succeed. Secondly, self-regulate the extreme components as the result of that success. Fame, wealth, power, influence. Consistent attunement. This is key. And I'll give an example from a case study of mine in the fourth seminar. Consistent attunement to internal needs, ideals, and purpose. To not lose that compass. When more has no endpoint, the pursuit becomes relentless and unsatisfied. More, like perfect, is not to have a goal. So you never get there. So you keep going. Perhaps the most succinct observation that I've heard was made by Kurt Vonnegut to his friend Joseph Heller at a party on Shelter Island given by a billionaire hedge fund manager. Vonnegut chided his friend Heller that their host had made more money in a single day than Heller had earned in his entire history of his immensely popular bestseller, Catch-22. Heller responded, "Yeah, but I have something he'll never have. Enough." So let's move now to what you see as the outline for Seminar 2. To look at some specific extremes of success as a model, as a prototype of things to deal with that you may not have experience with, you may not have a plan necessarily, or certainly a model of how to deal with it. So let's ask the broad question. Is significant success a liberation or a catastrophe? Let's look at some very well-known instruction or ideas from literature. Tennessee Williams observed in The Glass Menagerie how after several people become successful and the initial thrill wears off, they come to perceive their success as a catastrophe, even, as he put it, quotes, a kind of death. This paradox has been expressed by athletes, executives, scientists, entrepreneurs, generals, performers, and politicians. Or, on the other hand, remarkable success can create triumphant heroes and catalyze growth potential to continue unsurpassed accomplishment and successes for which there are no models or precedents. Pablo Picasso, in his 20s, outrageously drew a group of prostitutes in a brothel with faces resembling primitive African masks and dismembered cubic limbs. Hannibal, the Carthaginian general, in 218 BC, in his 20s, attacked the Roman Empire. Albert Einstein, also in his 20s, changed forever how we consider space, time, light, energy, and the universe. Let's look at this from a slightly different perspective. What do we attribute to someone who has significant success? What do we project onto them as if it were a Rorschach that we project what our experience is? Here are some of the things that are projected onto someone who has significant success. This is in the positive direction, okay? We're going to keep it clean. knowledge, wisdom, positive personal qualities, power, influence. These attributions then become what someone with significant success has to additionally deal with. They have to deal with those perceptions, both of self and by others of themselves. Each can alter one's own state, and it can permeate every social interaction and relationship. Each can lead to reactions of exceptionalism, self-serving impulsivity, erosion of empathy, and blurring of boundaries. It has a name: the hubris syndrome, the abuses of power. Now, the backstory, ghostwritten by the brain, of course, the pleasure center and the altruism center of the brain compete with one another. One or the other is controlled, but not both. When one fires, it shuts off the other one. When someone does something like nonprofit charity work for altruistic reasons, the altruism center is firing. Then, if money is offered, the altruism center shuts down and the pleasure center lights up. They're mutual antagonistic centers of the brain. So what difference does that make? Well, here are a couple of examples. One large blood center, low on supplies for transfusions, wanted to incentivize donations and decided to pay people to donate blood. Offering to pay had this result. It decreased the number of donors by 50%. What caused that result? What reversed it? Letting the donors contribute the payment to charity. It got back to where it was before. Another example, daycare centers in Israel began fining parents for late pickups. The number of tardy parents essentially doubled. Why? Well, the parents no longer felt ethically obligated to not inconvenience the teachers. They thought they were then paying the teachers for their lateness. Time became a paid commodity. Studies repeatedly show that a financial reward will undermine altruistic motivation. When the pleasure center hijacks the altruism center, motivation changes dramatically to self-interest. The altruism center and the pleasure center are the brain's version of a zero-sum game. Hubris usually refers to excessive confidence or even arrogance, but it can lead someone to disconnect from regard of others, to lessen attunement to others, heighten a belief in one's own power. An example is a financial professional who has been, and this is an example out of a whole caseload of studies, financial professional who's been consistently successful and overestimates ability and underestimate risk to result at times in unforced errors. The result of the mindset induced by this hubris can result in short-sighted or impulsive behavior without self-reflection and examination of consequences. So as a sidebar here, are you hearing how you need to really develop a working alliance with your client who is experiencing significant success, because you're going to have to engage them in a collaborative self-examination, in a collaborative examination of their behavior, their experience, so that it's not heard pejoratively, critically, judgmentally, and so that you can get away with saying whatever you need to say to keep that collaborative alliance and to do what you need to do as a coach. Executives, financial traders, other professionals who experience consistent success may expand risk-taking with lessened considerations of really balanced alternatives. Here's an example I saw unfold here in Houston. This was back in the day when I practiced as a shrink. Enron had a period of remarkable success and expansion. Jeffrey Skilling was CEO of the $60 billion company. Now, that was back in the 90s when that was really a lot of money. The company was named by Fortune magazine as the most innovative large corporation in America. The apparent hubris of the executives through sophisticated financial accounting schemes resulted in their ultimate downfall. Apparent relentless passion blinded to anything other than the total pursuit of more success. When all became known, the stock imploded and dropped from over $90 a share to barely 25 cents a share. In Greek mythology, Icarus believed himself invincible and flew too close to the sun, and his wings then melted for him to fall to earth and his death. Ponzi, Stanford, other con artists believe themselves to possess wings until they melt. More common examples include professionals such as attorneys, doctors, CEOs, who believe they cannot fail and don't listen to feedback or consider alternate scenarios. Hubris can lead to unforced errors. An arrogant position can result in failing to attune to basic issues. Another simple example, politicians who believe they're too popular, or they believe they're just popular, and will like to lose the election and decide to put less effort in campaigning. They surround themselves by people who reflect what they want to hear and what they want to believe. They surround themselves with a mirror of preformed images that they then project onto. Each of the accompanying aspects of significant success that include fame, power, money are like strong drugs, and each can be seductive to blur boundaries, erode empathy, and generate impulsive action. Now here, it's not the money itself. It's not the power itself. It's not the influence that one has, but the state of mind of the person who experiences this, who loses an anchor in their needs, in their ideals, in their game plan. They lose their compass to then live their success instead of live their ideals. The mindset of extreme success can lose purpose and compassion. So a result of the experience of power is dopamine release, which can itself lead to success intoxication, literally, biochemically, to focus on sustaining or enhancing that dopamine high. Especially vulnerable times, and this is where when you may begin to see clients or think about helping clients to anticipate these times, when there's no longer the natural source of power and stimulation. A natural example is the challenge for a CEO or a business owner or a pro athlete who retire and don't have that ongoing source of stimulation. Even during the experience of success and power, the pursuit can lead to impulsive action or addictive focus and pursuits, not just to enhance the feeling of excitement, but sometimes just to sustain it. Now, you've heard me talk before and have heard the term the hedonic treadmill effect. That's when the brain becomes accommodated to a particular stimulation, like becomes accommodated to naturally occurring dopamine in the sense of an experience or even sustained success, and needs more dopamine to increase stimulation just to maintain the same level of experienced pleasure. We now know from addiction work that once someone becomes addicted to a specific substance, the brain builds in more receptors for that substance in order to handle it, metabolize it, and any decrease of that substance is going to result in some variation of a craving experience. So the same happens here with this experience. A simple study to measure, to really apply this, to measure the experience of entitlement and impulsivity that can be accompanying this, was done at Dr. Dasher Keltner's Institute of Human Development Laboratory at UC Berkeley. Their team offered candies to participants who had completed studies. And beside that bowl of wrapped candies was a bold label. It was for people who had completed the study on their way out to grab a piece of candy. And it clearly said, for the children of Institute of Human Development, for the kids, in other words, not the adults, the candy was clearly meant for the children of the Institute study. The adults, though, who felt powerful and entitled because of wealth or position, took the candy themselves, as they seemed to feel entitled to write their own rules. Here's another example. In the United States, shoplifters take about $13 billion in goods from retailers each year. Now, what's your guess about who the shoplifters are? Researchers have surveyed this question, have surveyed the profile of shoplifters. Themes of power become evident in the data. Whites are more likely to shoplift than Asian, Latinos, and African Americans. And the wealthy who don't need to shoplift are more likely to shoplift than the poor. Self-serving impulsivity can transcend cultures, religion, and even morals. Consistently wealthier participants are more likely to say it's okay to engage in unethical acts like claiming government benefits for which they're not entitled, or avoiding payment of a fare on public transportation. Of course, the wealthy are probably not going to do that. Cheating on taxes, accepting a bribe. Each of these are an example of a sense of entitlement that can accompany the hubris of power, fame, wealth. Behavior, and I selected these because they particularly are in contradistinction to need. These studies were on people of wealth and how they took things and did things having to do with money that were an enactment of power and entitlement. Behaviors that are part of the hubris syndrome include an excessive self-reference of importance with the desire to exercise power without getting feedback from others. Think about the challenge that's going to be for anybody to listen to anybody else, the challenge for you as a mentor coach. I would say that we as mentor coaches have an almost exclusive, this is my hubris syndrome, an almost exclusive experience of how to deal with these people who have extreme success, because we do so by focusing on the choice architecture of the present moment, of looking at state regulation and creating a game plan where there isn't a model to proceed. Nobody else does that. Career counselors, therapists, counselors, other people, they don't do that. Counselors and therapists head the other direction. They look at the history, at the dynamics, at the feelings, at getting to the end of an old story, but not creating a new story. So this narrative, in addition to impulsivity and diminished empathy, huge, because they've also often lessened their own empathic connection with themselves. It can lead to someone writing their own rules. This narrative can include being an exception as a justification. This occurs, and when this occurs, someone is more likely to act in self-serving and even impulsive ways, justifying their actions based on self-interest. And this self-serving impulsivity can blur or occlude a moral compass. So we especially, as coaches, have to be aware of not being judgmental, looking at our own biases, our own algorithms for dealing with people, what may trigger us, in order to remain totally immersed in the client story and facilitating the client story to help them listen better and to listen to the whole story, that 90 to 95% of their operating system that's unconscious. So, what can prevent the hubris syndrome? This is also known as, how can you earn your money as mentor coach and bring exponential value? In his paper in the journal Clinical Medicine, Dr. David Owen indicates that those most likely to avoid the hubris syndrome remain grounded in their previous lifestyle and don't succumb to the trappings of power. In mentor coaching language, this includes sustaining a grounding in ideals and identity in order to maintain self-regulation, self-reflection of experiences and decisions. So this may be why one of the regularly jockeying for 1, 2, or 3 in the most wealthy people in the United States still lives in a house he built in 1952 and drives a car that's 20 years old and remains one of the world's elite billionaires, Warren Buffett. I'm not advocating this, I'm just giving you an example. This factor of having a valued confidant and or mentor coach to give accurate feedback and collaboration can mitigate hubris syndrome, can sustain self-awareness and humility. So here's a composite. Again, I would recommend that each of you think about writing down, and I want to pause for just a moment at the end of this seminar, as the others, pause for a moment for you to write down what your most important takeaway is from this material and what you've thought about. And remember, for those of you who are fresh off my neuromarketing, applying the mind and brain sciences to marketing your coaching practice, what you say to someone when you want to market your services or product is important. But the real key is not what you say. It's what that person says to himself or herself as a response to what you say that determines how they're going to proceed. So that's what you want to do, is to be attuned to how someone hears and processes what you're saying, because it's going to be a unique processing for that person at this time in this state of mind. Because remember, every state of mind is its own software package, and every software package has its own unique way of perceiving, processing, and acting on what's there. So here's a composite of these 7 steps, the roadmap system to sustain and expand success. Being empathic and focused on the experience and well-being of others to sustain that. Prioritize interests of others alongside your own. Now, you may think about if you need to convert any of these into questions. Read it, throw it away, and then get in the flow of the conversation, but let this inform how you're listening so that you can answer questions in the moment, in the flow, not based on the changing of state or a choke, which is to think about it for a minute. Remember, Yogi Berra said, you can't think and hit at the same time. Focus on the positive in others to enhance their contributions. Use the excitement as inspiration for creative contributions. Think about expressing gratitude. Who are you grateful to in your successful accomplishments? That requires getting beyond the orbit of that state of mind of sustain. Have you expressed it? Create a unifying success story to understand and guide. This is what we help our clients do, to create a new story that incorporates a new model and the experiences and the fundamentals, the foundation of identity, of needs and ideals applied to new situations. And we do that step by step, a little increment, several times, probably during each coaching session. So, enduring power comes from attunement to others, including empathy, giving, expressing gratitude, and fashioning stories that unite. Enduring power, that's a way to keep and enhance power, to reside as the creator of that story of success, including power, rather than to get lost in it. Unifying stories for oneself and for others can inform and form cohesive narratives of connection and mutual benefit. With exceptional success, narratives of exceptionalism that naturally accompany the process need to be consistently monitored to ground in self-awareness, as well as the social and organizational context or family context or all of the above. To achieve extreme success through exceptional, creative, and even compassionate action, if it results in behavior based on accompaniments of wealth, power, fame, influence, can become an extreme success paradox. A result of extreme success to act in self-centered or arrogant or even unethical ways may not sustain and certainly may not enhance that success, and it can well undermine it. So, a final question. How does exceptional success influence power? Power, like the accompaniments of wealth and fame, permeates every social interaction and relationship. Also, there are numerous ways to alter the state of others. Money, employment, security, gifts, social access. Power creates an experience of effectiveness in especially altering the states and opinions and preferences of others. Power is founded in social networks. One determinant is how well we empower others of that network. Behavior becomes infectious with social networks to become catalysts of social change and influence. Actions from donation to diet to exercise will influence your friends, even the friends of your friends who do not know you. For example, when you become generous to share something with a stranger, that stranger then is 19% more generous in subsequent interactions with new strangers who have never seen you. Those new strangers then become 7% more generous in their interactions with other strangers twice removed from you. The impact and influence of power becomes how we empower others in our social, business, and professional networks. Knowledge, wisdom, and other positive regards become assigned to someone with fame and wealth. Power shapes what others think of a person. Rorschach attributions, a collection of characteristics of someone, forms a reputation. When positive, the reputation then furthers the capacity for influence. Social influencers develop a significant following, the source of some of their power. Reputation amplifies this influence. William James, the father of psychology, asserted 130 years ago, the deepest principle in human nature is craving to be appreciated, to be effective in influencing someone else. Neuroscience has validated this idea, showing that when subjects receive positive statements or status-elevating expressions, this activates the region of the brain that's associated with positive regard and triggers dopamine, the ventral striatum. The effectiveness of exercising power to influence others elicits a response in the pleasure chemical dopamine. It can be enhancing, or if not regulated, it can turn to excess and abuse. Again, this is a model that we're talking about and a simple example of that. This, you may find, applies to other situations, but we're talking about the fundamentals, the foundation of the mind, brain, and performance sciences. So the illustration is something only as an application for you to think about, an application for you, for your client. This brain mechanism involving the pleasure chemical creates its own appetite for positive response and elevated status. It can sustain innovative work and even prestigious awards that recognize contribution. Altruism and competition can compete for the same reward, though. Since our life stories are made up of patterns, our successful reflection and recognition of these patterns becomes crucial for both coherence and success. This is our specialty as mentor coaches, in my view. Adopting a systematic way to construct the narrative of our lives both creates and sustains success. The transformation of our thinking about, for example, influence and power in our daily lives include how it shapes our interactions as parents, as colleagues, and with clients. The stimulation of dopamine resulting from the acquisition of fame, wealth, power creates its own state of mind and can be life-changing. In fact, it's hardly ever not life-changing. Often, the greater the deviation from a previous normal as a reaction to remarkable success can determine the extremes of its effects. The experience of this pleasurable excitement, with the anticipation even of success, and the experience of its results becomes a sought-after experience. We want to sustain it. We want to enhance it. In fact, it takes over a bit more experience with the same effect as previously. It requires more of the same, the hedonic treadmill. This accommodation in our brain, biologically and psychologically, has the effect of wanting to sustain it with gradual increments required. When this experience does not provide it, alternatives are sought. This can derail someone when a substitute use by an athlete, drug use, who can no longer perform. The esteem and response of others becomes a continued source of fulfillment. Being focused externally, it can only last for a little while, and it has to be replenished. The repetition creates its own habituation and consequence. This stimulation resulting from success then can take on a life of its own. It can eclipse needs and ideals, and as we've talked, even conclude with a lack of empathy for others to pursue it. Part of the seduction of the results of success can be to abandon ideals, disregard others. The state of mind fueled by dopamine can become its own pursuit. It can be very much like the substance abuse addict. In short, more power can lead to decreased empathy, less resonance with others, and some compromise of compassion, gratitude, altruism. The role of the mentor coach now. How can we help our client to undergo significant change and transformation, especially when the experiences may be very different for them than previous ones? This example of extreme success may require decisions that cannot be ceded to logic, to scientific inquiry, or especially for the client's previous experience. There may be no normative standard to frame or anchor a life-changing decision that also changes the future. What can we focus on to consider possibilities in the face of significant change? As I mentioned, first develop a working alliance with your client. The client has to know that you are 100% invested in their success. For this coaching engagement, a collaborative framework and empathic attunement so the client feels you're in it together to co-create and implement success strategies. Three areas to consider. Again, this is a kind of review. The initial mastery of self-regulation states of mind to balance the stimulation of excess emotion, the temptation to respond impulsively. Second, and this is from our perspective as coaches again, clarity and loyalty to their foundation of personal identity, needs and ideals, that bedrock of self, and also perhaps shifting a perspective. A year or 5 years from now, what will you look back to be glad you've done? So here are four fundamental questions to inform the development of this evolving model with the client. What was the most unprecedented or extreme experience you dealt with successfully before this? What personal tools did you use for that experience? What best practices can be applied now to navigate this situation? And fourth, who will you become in making the choices you consider? A couple of things that may be helpful to consider in collaboration with clients who are dealing with these issues. And these are things to listen for. Identity foreclosure is when you limit your mindset about what you may be capable of achieving and adapting to. Remember that identity is not just about who you are or what you do, but it's also what you believe going forward, especially about yourself. Secondly, remember our brains want to foreclose things, so we will and avoid any dissonance of keeping it open. So that means we'll jump to a conclusion and find validation to make that the right conclusion. Second, then, identity paralysis is stuckness where a basic operating model, beliefs, and identities do not adaptively change. Somebody sticks to the same model, fixed belief, ideas about limitations, other personality biases can lead to identity paralysis. As mentor coaches, this concept of identity is something that we, I believe, always need to address to be sure that the changes a client makes becomes internalized to transform their identity. Purpose and ideals can be a compass despite potential detours and distractions. So a final two questions are about talent. What's the role of talent in exceptional performance? This is a reiteration for those of you who have done the performance enhancement seminars with me. Laszlo Polgár rejected the notion of innate talent. He was way before neuroscience and cognitive psychology to know this, emphasizing that two things could help a child become a genius in any field: deliberate practice, and good habits. His theory, a genius is not born, but educated and trained. So he put this to practice. He tested his theory with his three daughters, Susan, Sophia, and Judith, to train them early on in chess and raise them to later become chess prodigies. Susan, the oldest, began playing chess when she was 4 years old. Within 6 months, she was defeating adults. Sophia, the middle daughter, was a world champion at 14 years old and soon thereafter became a grandmaster. Judith, the youngest, by age 12 was the youngest player ever listed in the top 100 chess players in the world. 3 years later, she became the youngest grandmaster of all time, beating Bobby Fischer, the previous record holder. Judith was considered the strongest female chess player of all time. We now know from several perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a developmental process. Fundamental talent, when present, can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, and nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, or mentors. Commitment needs to be fueled by passion and framed by purpose. So, is there a disadvantage of talent? Talent, the talent myth can lead to a fixed mindset. This is always what we're listening for as coaches. Why spend time and energy trying to improve? Success only comes to people with the right talent or genes. While basic talent is a variable, it's not what fundamentally separates world-class performance in business, arts, most sports, in most situations, or science from everyone else. Talent can be a potential disadvantage because somebody with a natural talent may not initially subject themselves to the same hard work, rigor, and dedication to skill development as someone without those abilities. Natural talent can be great for a period of time, but if it replaces discipline and dedication to practice that needs to be developed, it can be a disadvantage. Those with less skill early on have to work harder to develop it, may establish a systematic way to grow and improve in this process. Also, those with less talent may develop related skills to supplement their achievement, things like knowing their opponent and engagement strategies to persevere through adversity. So a shadow story of talent also is it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a period of time, maybe even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. And that's just a simpler way of stating the subtext of what we're talking about in these four seminars is how do you play a bigger game and stay at it and enjoy it? So I'm moving to our discussion mode to hear from you, any questions or clarification. We have just a very few minutes. We're in discussion mode now. I'm interested for any questions, clarifications, or anyone to share your major takeaway. What you got?
Dave, hi. Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, this is...
It's Mike out in New Jersey. How are you?
Welcome. How are you, Mike? Go ahead.
Good, thanks. Good. You know, the one takeaway that I'm getting from this, honestly, is that, we just seem to, we've gotten into this culture of self-esteem, and it's clear that, you know, our results are always better when we feel good about ourselves and worse when we don't. But it's almost like this idea of self-esteem has become kind of a drug unto itself. And we've lost the ability to kind of challenge our results or question our results or doubt our results and test the reasons why the outcome that we're getting may be wrong or may be a false positive or a false negative. How do we, I guess part of our job as coaches is to be that devil's advocate for our clients and help them say, okay, you know, it came out the way that you wanted. Are the results how much of those results are a direct result of your methodology? And how much of it might just be coincidence? Take the personal out of it. You know, instead of leaping to slapping ourselves on the back and rewarding ourselves for the results, step back and say, okay, you know, how much of this is coincidence? And how much of this is actual effort or technique or the process that we put in place, and maybe our job as coaches is to bring that to the table for our clients, where they may be a little bit blinded to that themselves.
Okay, Mike, I want to challenge you now so that we can focus just briefly. Can you summarize that into one sentence of 10 to 12 words that I can address?
How are we kidding ourselves with our results? And how do we get past that?
Okay, that's a great question. And I want to get back to the basics with that. And this is basic internal dynamics. You talked about self-esteem and losing track of that. I want to do a definition. The only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having an internal ideal that's attainable and living up to it. And I mentioned reflecting on and going back to this fundamental foundation of our identity, of our own self-esteem, our own ideals, as part of what we listen for and help a client with. Now, what's the result of failure to live up to self-esteem? It's shame. So this is an internal matter first. That's why I often, with a new client in mentor coaching, will send them two basic exercises to determine their core premier needs and ideals, their top three needs and their top three ideals, because this is often helpful to them to clarify and specify that, because whatever we do in coaching, we need to know that, because that's their foundation, that's their compass. When they're true to that, they have esteem and they can achieve success consistent with their identity and build on that. If they don't know clearly their needs and their ideals, if you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So that informs both of us what their fundamental needs and fundamental ideals are that will be useful in any kind of strategy and goal setting, because when needs and ideals are aligned and achieved, that's dynamite. All of the person is going in the same direction. It also can help in what we're talking about in extreme situations, either really good or really bad. And I've seen again and again, it's easier sometimes to handle the really bad, especially if somebody's got feeling bad down, than to handle the really good, because there's no model for it. There's probably all kind of models for feeling bad and problems, but this is what someone doesn't have a model for. So establishing those fundamental needs and ideals, I put those top three needs and top three ideals inside the folder for each client, so that I have easy reference to it, and it's often helpful to both of us, because that's what will be guiding. That's what's the fundamental foundation of identity, and that will feel as authentic. And when they live into their ideals, that's where self-esteem comes from, and that's going to be both validating and enhancing, and they're going to want more. But we also have a point to return to, the foundation, and to look at where the compass is pointing. So it's a great question. Maybe we can elaborate. I went over, and my covenant with you guys is to stop on time. Thank you for that, Mike. I hope it begins, and maybe we can have a further discussion about this, because that may have only touched aspects of that, even if you agree with it. I know it's not complete. So we'll pick up here next time for our Seminar 3. Thank you guys very much for all of the feedback and responses. I'll be eager to hear from each of you. Be thinking about what you want to talk about more in Seminar 4, and if anybody's willing to also, we already have one going, if anybody's also willing to present another case, or a couple of you to present a vignette to talk about. So thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves. See you next week. Bye now.